Hello and welcome. My name is Kyle, and this is How You Level Up, a podcast that decodes language to help you become your best self. Yeah, so I can kick us off in terms of the cooing on my side is my son eating a bottle, and he is joining us in today's session. He did not read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick, which is a fiction, sci-fi fiction book, and was the inspiration for the movie Blade Runner. You know, when I knew that this book was the inspiration for Blade Runner, I thought, okay, I'm going to get the story of Blade Runner again. And that was not the case.
Not at all.
Yeah, it was similar in some sense and very different in other senses.
Yeah.
As far as I remember, the only thing that's the same was the replicants just that there were androids that were indistinguishable from humans. I think the complete storyline, I believe, was different. But I also don't remember the movie that much.
I was really excited to read this because... Have you guys ever watched The Bear?
I watched the first season.
In the first season, Richie, which is like the crazy guy that works there, the white guy that yells all the time, he says he loves Philip K. Dick. And working in restaurants, weirdly, I've encountered two separate people in restaurants that have told me that Philip K. Dick is a genius. And I was just, you know, I'd never really read one of his books, so I was really excited, and it was kind of funny for me to jump into it. I thought, first of all, the difference between the book and the movie, I could not comprehend how they got the imagery out of the book. Like, Blade Runner is such an iconic piece of cinema, and stylistically it's iconic, and the city of San Francisco is everything's iconic about it in the future. And I thought it was like amazing to see just how creative a director or somebody can be with a piece of literature and to create this entirely separate world that in some ways it felt grounded. You know, like the funny thing about a novel and a movie is a novel you're inside of the character's head, whereas a movie has to express these things through, you know, a look or the actors without saying much expressing what, you know, the characters in the book are experiencing internally. So I thought, you know, maybe we can talk about the themes of this book and your overall thoughts. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think it's also a nice break before we talk about the themes of the book. I think it's a nice break from reading nonfiction because I spent years reading nonfiction books exclusively, and so now I find that like many of the fiction books that I want to read, they have these themes, which we'll talk about in a moment, that influence so much of our society as a whole, because they're entertaining, because they're playing with things that then we can test later on in science, because it's a way for us to express creatively how is it that our society is impacting us through fictional storytelling. Mm-hmm. So Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is the story of Rick Deckard, and he is a bounty hunter hired by the police department to find androids who are living inside of the city. This is a post-apocalyptic world where there was war on Earth, and androids are come from another planet. I don't want to give too much away. I want people to be interested in reading it if they listen. So Rick is a bounty hunter. He's not quite a police officer, but the story in the book unfolds as he is given a job to go find some androids who are runaways, escapee androids that are inside the city. And the job that he has taken over had a police officer or a different bounty hunter who was just hurt and is now in the hospital. So he's taking over that job. And we are led to believe as the readers that it's dangerous because the last person who was on the job was injured and is now in the hospital. You know, some of the major themes about the book is, of course, androids, artificial intelligence, being able to identify what is artificial intelligence as compared to a human. You know, visually, it's near impossible. So the way that the bounty hunters identify androids is through a test. And that test is one that measures bodily function, empathy, and you know, the idea of what do androids care about. What are some of the other things, perhaps?
I thought that what the book really centered around and the focal point of it was empathy, and I think that in a really short time and in a really short book, Philip K. Dick really paints a picture that of a society that is essentially devoid of any real meaning, and he does that through the focus on people's obsession with acquiring these electric animals or real animals, even though most animals are extinct on planet Earth at this point. And I thought that it was a really strange thing to read, of these people who are obsessed with acquiring, like the only thing they think about, or that Rick Deckard thinks about, is like, how do I acquire an electric animal? And his whole, it's almost like his quest to search for something that gives him some feeling in his life, some form of feeling alive. And it's not clear whether there are moments where the, you know, spoiler alert here, but there are moments where the androids lack empathetic responses towards animals. But then it's also not clear if the newer models feel, I felt this way, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, if the newer models begin to feel some sort of empathy. And I think that he sort of leaves the door open for you to question whether or not Deckard is an android. And I think he does that in the title, which is "Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?" He's sort of putting it out there because the empathy test is a series of questions that that ask increasingly absurd and like horrifying questions to test the response of the human or the android and to gauge their response to it. I thought it was really a story about empathy and searching for empathy in a society that's completely lost all meaning for it, so much so that they have an electronic item that gives them feeling and emotion when they want to feel a certain emotion.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say it that way, because how I took the electric animals was, okay, so I'm gonna try to repeat what you said so that to make sure I'm understanding it. Your impression of the electrical animals was like, Rick, the main character, really wants an animal, but he's got an electric sheep, and so like he's thinking about his sheep all the time, and ideally he wants a good real animal, but what he's got is an electric animal. I took that to be a in this society, in this book, everybody has an animal that they care for, because animals, like you said, are mostly extinct. And the fact that people culturally in this care for electric animals is a byproduct of, after the war on Earth, it was really important for everyone to care for an animal to create some sort of food. And so if you didn't have an animal, you weren't caring for the world. And so if you then didn't have an animal, you could get an electric animal, and then you are perceived as caring for the world. And it's like that's all a facade. It doesn't actually matter. If you have an electric animal, what a waste of time is how I took it. Like, you're doing it for a show rather than for practical, actual purpose. And that I took to be as like, how many other things in our world, in our culture, in America, are we doing not because it's useful, but because it's a facade for, are you also a member of society?
Right. Great. That's a great insight. Absolutely. I didn't think of that.
Yeah. I also didn't think of that. I wasn't sure that, I guess I thought that the animals were, like the real animals were much more prized than the fake ones. Right. But Kyle, you're saying that they were more prized just for fake reasons.
Yeah. So the idea is like, yes, the real animals were prized more, but people still purchased electric animals and hid the fact that they had an animal that was electric from their neighbors because they're supposed to be perceived as being valuable to culture and, you know, the city.
Oh, right. Yeah. So
have an animal, because if you don't have an animal, you are not helping. And it's like, well, you should then accept the fact that if you don't have a real animal, why spend the money to buy an electric animal? That's just a facade. You're not doing anything.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. I gotcha. Yeah. It wasn't as important. It was basically like the difference of buying like a watch, like a real Rolex versus a fake Rolex. Like, yes, people had the fake Rolex. If you have a fake Rolex, it still like looks the same, but like deep down, you know, it's really not like as meaningful, right?
Or a good example would be, culturally, it is perceived that if you have a big diamond ring, that you have status and wealth. Mm-hmm. It's like, it doesn't actually matter whether or not your diamond ring is large. You could be a billionaire and have a tiny diamond ring. You could be poor as hell, but have purchased a very large diamond ring. It's part of the show that we put on for each other and actually doesn't have utility in culture.
Hmm. Gotcha. Yeah, that's interesting. And on Doug, one of your points I thought was good, how the newer models of the androids are obviously like the most advanced by far and completely indistinguishable. There were moments throughout the book where the Nexus 6 types do show empathy, which is really interesting. They showed empathy for their fellow androids, right? Like, there was one instance where one of the androids, when they were huddled up, the three of them hiding out, and one of them got scared, I think, when Rick came in and tried to help the other two. That's an example of an android showing empathy. So, I think empathy was one of probably the main theme of the book, and where the author was trying to, you know, like, distill between what's real empathy, what's fake empathy, you know, what's artificial. And yeah, like, I actually agree with you, Doug. I think throughout the book that the author made it unclear whether the main character was an android or not. One thing that's really interesting on the empathy part is that there's times throughout the book where even the humans, or who we think are humans, do not show any empathy towards other humans. And like, an example of that is like the chicken head thing, where they look at those chicken heads, which are just another type of human, much more down upon than non-chicken heads, basically. And so I thought that was interesting. I think that there were just a lot of like, it's one of those books where it's like you have to almost read twice to understand all of the hidden meaning and symbolism and everything. It's sort of tough to wrap your mind around it as you're reading it, I feel like. But lots of really interesting insights about like human empathy versus artificial empathy. I also just, yeah, I enjoyed the, like, getting through, like, the, once you, I guess this is any fiction book, but once you, like, really understand the characters a little bit more, you kind of just fly through the book, and I felt that was the case for me, where it took maybe 50 pages or so to understand the characters and, like, what their deal was and stuff, and then I really enjoyed it afterwards.
Completely agree. Yeah.
I wanted to say, you know, maybe we could bring it to reality a little bit, which is, I thought that the machine that where his girlfriend is constantly trying to feel depressed or trying to feel like, hey, go turn this on and you're just going to feel fine, was almost like a precursor to smartphones or something. Like, are the way that we just turn things on, oh, I'm feeling like I don't understand the world and I'm feeling kind of scared, and you're like, let me just play a game or do something to distract me from this emotion so I can feel something else rather than sitting, you know, realizing the reality of my life, which is like I live in this miserable hellhole.
Yeah.
That is San Francisco. What year? It's always funny when you read science fiction because these guys wrote in like the 70s and they were like in 2030. This is like sometimes the stories are in 2030. I can't remember.
I think this was 2020.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's always funny when you read where they thought we were headed.
Thank God we didn't end up here.
Yeah.
Quite a dark world. The box itself. So this. I too felt as if this was like a phone where you connect to it and it gives you some sort of experience. The way they talked about it in the book was that it was this black box that sat in the living room and you sat down or kneeled next to it and you put both of your hands on like hand holders on it. And it did have a religious connotation of Mercerism, which was the religion identified and talked about in the book, which we can get to later. But this box, you could program it to feel depressed. You could program it to feel feeling, which was interesting. Like, if you're not feeling anything, go to 107 or 108, and then you'll feel something. So it was almost as if humanity at this point in this fictional world were unable to express themselves naturally and then relied upon this black box for one, their connection to Mercerism, or Mercer is their prophet in the religion. And two, it's the only way to truly feel a thing is by connecting first and then experience it.
I wanted to ask, because I was a little confused when he starts having almost like visions of Mercer. And it starts getting almost spiritual where he accepts, like, I am Mercer.
Yeah.
And I was so, I think that that's something I had to sit with a little bit longer because it's almost like he just needs something to believe in, which is, he needs like a higher order. It didn't matter that it was like a religion that we know, it was like a higher order in the world. And he like latched onto it and starts having almost like spiritual experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. After his animal died, right. He,
yeah.
His electric animal.
Yeah.
No, it was a real animal. It was a real animal.
The goat? Died.
The goat. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Which he bought, you know, for all of his money.
All the shekels, every last one.
And yeah, it's like, that's a good point, Doug. After that, he had no meaning. He had no reason to live. He spent all his money on the one thing he wanted, which is a real animal. He had finally made it in life with the real animal, basically. And then it died. And yeah, that's where kind of religion came into play, where he had these visions and he believed that he was Mercer, which is the the god of this religion. I think it's, yeah, it's, I don't know. I didn't fully understand the reason for including all of the religious stuff in the book around Mercerism. And then there's the whole thing at the end where, it was revealed through a discovery that the whole religion was fake anyways, which I guess is interesting to talk about, right? I'm sure there's some parallels with that and also humans versus androids of like what's fake and what's real. Do either of you guys want to talk about the religion aspect of it?
Yeah. So this too is, Doug, you said it, where it's, you know, seeking a higher power. And I thought that the point of including it was humans believed in Mercerism, and Mercerism is a way to feel empathy. Rick's wife, and Rick himself, when connecting to the box, you feel things and you have a physical experience where in your mind, whatever happens, if you have a vision of Mercer, the prophet or savior of the religion, you see Mercer getting hit with rocks. People are throwing rocks at Mercer. And if you see Mercer get hit with a rock, you too get hit with the rock and you come away from the black box with a scrape. I think that's, you know, fantastical in the storytelling itself, but I don't think we need to read too far into that. The visions of, or like the need to have the vision, the value of the religion itself is that we do need a higher power. And if you don't believe in a deity in theology, you're going to replace that higher power with something else, like science. So much of the scientific community who are not scientists and say, believe in the science, they're replacing religion with the all-encompassing, if you don't believe this, then you are the villain. That's not how science works. Science is a theory that is tested, replicated, and if talked about and, you know, proven, then it stays as fact. Until there are more facts that refute the evidence, or more evidence that is presented that refutes the current standing of how things are. That's science. Science is not a black and white thing. It is a thing that evolves across time. But if you don't believe in a higher power and you start to take religion as your higher power, as the androids do, right? The androids don't believe in Mercer. They think it's all fake. Then you're not going to be able to identify in yourself what is a zealous belief and what is just something that you take to be true at the moment that could change in the future. Which part of total spoilers at this point. I mean, you better look before listening to this. The androids, there's a like a loop of a person talking on news on a news station constantly. They are androids, right? The androids that are in hiding allude to this, that they're the same as us. And they're trying to say to all of humanity on Earth, that Mercerism is false. Whether or not we should believe that is left up in my mind to interpretation. I don't know whether or not we're supposed to believe that Mercerism is false. I think that we're supposed to see that what is told to people is that Mercerism is false. Doesn't mean it is false.
That's interesting.
What's interesting too, and if you put these two things side by side, the Mercerism, is that Rick Deckard is a man of action. Like, he is driven to accomplish goals, to do things, but Philip K. Dick does something kind of funny where everything is sort of subverted because you're like, at the end of this goal is this goat, you know? So it's kind of funny. Everything he's trying to achieve, he's basically said, like, all your goals, all your achievements, if the system is built a certain way, like, where are you going, you know? And his only escape at the end from the system is, I need to believe in this thing that as we come to find out, if it's true that there are androids saying that Mercerism isn't real, that the androids don't want me to believe. It's like my only way to retain something of myself or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely, I'm finding it harder to discuss, you know, a science fiction book like this than our,
I think that's because we, and you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you have to infer the connections from the author's story to reality. And mm-hmm. it's a little bit, it's not that it's harder, it's that you have to do it in a roundabout way. Sort of what inference is. I'm kind of just saying synonyms here. Partly because I don't know if that's like hitting the mark with you, so I'm trying to say it differently. Like the connection of Mercerism to religion as a whole, right? Androids don't feel empathy. It could even be like there's one part of the book where we could infer, you know, there was a time when Rick was picked up by police, and the police force that he was picked up by was another police force in the city that he had never heard of. And I think part of, you know, the eventual outcome of that is that, you know, that was a secret police force that was actually run by androids, and there happens to be another bounty hunter that was in that second police force, and then he ends up killing his commissioner. We can take that to sort of be also a parallel of our military might or police or, you know, three-letter acronym organizations, you know, NSA, CIA, FBI, they have no idea what other people are doing, and yet they are supposed to work in conjunction with each other to collaborate and corroborate. And very often what they end up doing is building more friction for the other team if those who are at the top, the commissioner, the directors, are not coordinated well enough across domains. Like we could draw a conclusion there too. It might be a little bit of a stretch, but that's what I was thinking about while reading that section.
Yeah. The coolest part of the book for me was the most mind-bending, which was like where I was questioning everything at this point, where Rick Deckard, I don't need to go into details, but basically he's making an arrest of someone, and the woman who he's arresting calls the police and says that, you know, he's harassing her. And Rick Deckard says to the police, "Hey, yeah, just look up my badge number, whatever." And the police says, "We have no record of you being a part of this department, right? Yeah, we have no idea who you are, and we've never heard of your boss, right? We have our own bounty hunters, and we've never heard of you." And at that point, you're like, "Okay, is his whole charade, or is his whole, you know, job of being a bounty hunter, is it all some sort of charade?" And they take him into a police station. And he's never heard of this police station, and it's in San Francisco, same city as him, but just like a different part of town. And that was really cool, because I was like, it ended up not being too significant, I don't think, to the storyline, but it was a point in the book where I was like questioning everything, and it was kind of cool to read something like that.
Yeah, me too. That moment where he's like, it's almost like the Spider-Man meme pointing at each other, like, who are you? Am I real? Like, who's an android? Who's not?
Yeah. And then at that point I thought Rick was obviously an android, and that, you know, he was not a legitimate bounty hunter. It ended up not being the case. So I guess it ended up being that the fake police station was just android run. Right. And it was just set up basically to try and capture the real bounty hunters.
What's another cool thing is the way that he, because it's such a short book, but like when he puts the corporation, when he goes to visit the corporation, and they're creating they're creating the Nexus 6 models.
That was a cool scene, yeah.
And so they're essentially creating the problem of the entire story.
Yeah.
Which is like the problem of society, which is how do we need to figure out who's an android, who's not. And in a weird way, there's this moment where Rick is testing a girl who you think just who works there, who you find out's an android, who plays a very significant role. He's testing her, and it's almost like the company is using him to test if the product is fooling him. It's a funny,
yeah.
It's like a funny insertion, and then it's just sort of this ominous floating thing that you don't really go back. You don't, he doesn't go back there. It's mentioned again, you know, because the character of Rachel appears, but it's just I thought it's funny how he did so much with so little. Like, it's a really, aside from just the text, it's like a cool study of just how to tell a story without telling. You don't have to describe every inch of the organization. You just like put these things out there, and you let the reader's imagination kind of run wild. Scott, I wanted to say one more thing just related to literature, which is when you're like on page 50 is when I got into the flow of it. It's really, there's like a ongoing kind of a meme or with Russian literature, but that happens at like page 300. You know, you're like 300 pages in, you're like, who? And then at 300 pages, you're like, this is the best thing I've ever read in my entire life.
Yeah, that's like every fiction book is like that for me. I haven't read fiction in a bit, so this was good to come back to. But it takes time to really be interested in the world that the fiction writer creates.
Yeah.
And that's, you just got to be a little bit patient for the story to develop a little bit. Where nonfiction is not like that at all, right? Like, nonfiction just gets right into it, and you can just start learning and stuff right away. But yeah, I think fiction has a lot of good merits. Like you said earlier, Kyle, it can help you understand or like imagine a different kind of world, right? With different kind of circumstances and technologies and everything. Sci-fi is definitely a cool genre. I don't know would you guys want to.
I think it's
continue.
I think for us, and if anyone's listening to this, I think it's actually healthy for us to do. Like,
yeah.
I think it exercises a part of our brains that we don't really utilize anymore, which is like connect. It is more difficult to have a conversation about it because it's not so matter of fact. It's not just laid out in front of us. There isn't a point that's necessarily explicit and trying to get across the way a nonfiction book would, which is, you know, a lot easier to interpret or disagree with or argue against. But it allows us to connect all these things that we're reading and sort of search for those themes within the book. You know, I think it's like I think it's healthy for humans in general to try and read literature and understand what's being said and how it relates to the world that you live in, and you know, higher order principles and things like that. I think it's like a muscle that we can exercise, which is, you know, we'll get better at it as we have more discussions. I think we could pick, you know, we could continue with science. I have a list of the 100 greatest science fiction novels ever, and we can continue with science fiction. We could do anything, but I think we should, you know, switch it. We should try to read literature for sure.
Yeah.
Reading fiction and then nonfiction, or multiple nonfiction and then a fiction book. Let's definitely keep doing it because, Doug, you just articulated it super well. And also, it's a nice break from like the continuous, what, let me learn something nonfiction or let me remember a part of history type of thing. That's fun.
Yeah. There's so many good classic, you know, literature fiction books that we can read, but there's also just so many nonfiction books. I just bought the book. I've been stacking up my books. I just bought the, Doug, have you read this one? It's called How it's the Jim Simons book, like How He Solved the Market or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Great book. That's an amazing book. The Man Who Solved the Market.
The Man Who Solved the Market, yeah.
Man, that book is in... That guy is another level of genius. Literally. He created an algorithm.
He's next level.
Essentially next an level. AI model he created But you know what's funny? Well, yeah, I'll tell you because it's still interesting to read no matter what because it's nonfiction. But
yeah, I know the basic story anyways.
But what's funny is that there's moments where the market's crashing and he's still reacting like a human. Like he has this system and he's still calling his guy like, what do I do? Like, what do we do here? You know, like he's...
But does he act on that or does he let the algorithm run?
Sometimes he would go on his instinct, but mostly he would go based off of the algorithm. But he did something really interesting, which is once they hit a certain amount of return, he bought anybody that wasn't involved in making it function. He took them out of the company.
Anyone that
wasn't involved in the function of the company, he took them out. Like, so everybody that was working at the company, that was building the models, they're the ones that make all the money. Like all his investors, he started buying them out. And buying up their...
Oh, right. So, yeah, what? So they no longer... I mean, he died, but the firm is still running, but they no longer accept outside capital.
Yeah.
Because they realize that we can just make all the money ourselves. Yeah. Our algorithm's so good, like, we don't need outside money.
Yeah.
And their performance is incredible. Like, I forget the numbers, but it's like 5X.
He was making, like, 80% returns sometimes. That's a great book, man. There's another one that's really good called The Man Who, I think it's A Man for All Markets, and he's the original. He's in the, I think he started in like the 50s. He started gambling. He started taking down casinos, and he figured out that made
Taleb. Taleb he just did the foreword of this book.
Yeah.
The cool thing about Jim Simons is that he, like no one's been able to replicate it. Even with like the latest and greatest of AI the last few years, or like firms like Jane Street, like all these quant funds have not been able to replicate it. And so it's some like crazy secret sauce that he thought of. Like it's probably simpler than we think. But it just like works, and it's probably hidden in a vault. Like there's definitely no one who knows about it, or maybe some people.
What his strength was that that guy really should have been doing theoretical mathematics. I mean, that's what he should have been doing with his life.
No, I think he was doing that though.
He was in college. Yeah. He's a crazy character, man. When you read about him, you're like, this guy is out of his mind, and so
smokes cool. A lot of cigs,
thousands, millions. It's got to be in the millions. I respect that.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
All right. Yeah, so next up, Beginning of Infinity.
Yeah.
This will be a wild ride.
Your copy, Savedio?
It's Savedio.
This is going to be a wild ride.
Say again, Doug.
Does he have a middle name?
Dean.
Savedio Dean Nelson.
This is going to be a journey, guys. I think, like, I don't know how long you think we'll need on this.
I'll be honest. It's already started it, and I'm, I think, chapter, like, 5 or 6.
Oh, yeah? What do you think so far?
It's good. I'm reading it at the same time as the book that I suggested for my next one and you don't want to read.
Which one?
Which is interesting. Because they have parallels, like many parallels.
Eliza Yudkowsky book?
Yeah, The Map and Territory.
Yudkowsky, he's a character, man.
Yeah. So I'm going to, in our conversation about the Beginning of Infinity, I'm going to bring in topics from Rationality.
Okay. Doug, you know this guy, Yudkowsky?
No, never heard of him.
He's one of the creators of like EA, which is like Sam Bankman-Fried ideology, effective altruism. he's one of the leaders and just like wrote a lot about rationality, and now his whole
Did you stop recording yourself, Scott? All right.
How long ago?
Just now.
Scott.
See ya.
Scott. What if we just left?
What if him clicking that took him out of reality? And we only know about him because we were on this video call with him.
He got what's the thing where it's like the cornucopia and Fruit of the Loom?
Yes.
Scott is the cornucopia.
We have remembered it being that way, but it was never that way.
That would be amazing if only we knew about Scott. That would be a fun, that would be a cool book.
That would be definitely a very cool story.
Like
how would you write it?
I don't know, like five friends who know that their one friend existed, but the rest of the world, and he was like he was super famous. He did something. They know that he existed, but the rest of the world, he's the cornucopia.
Yes, yes.
And that's a book title, The Cornucopia.
The Cornucopia.
Yeah.
There's maybe you'll know this. I think there was a movie or a show where some guy went back in time and the Rolling Stones were like a rock band, never existed, but he knew all of their songs.
Oh, the Beatles.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. 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 Yeah, there's some, that's a theme that has played out here and there. I think the theme or the idea there is like time.
Yeah.
Right. Or memory. Time. I don't know. Maybe not.
Time.
Everything loops back to time, Doug.
Time. Yeah, I'm. Scott said he can't rejoin, but he said he's not letting him in.
What a loser! No, yeah. Totally cool guy,
or whoever that guy is. I'm forgetting him. Dude, yeah. I'm reading. I'm been hitting philosophy lately.
Okay.
Unbelievable. Just the most fruitful reading I've ever done.
Yeah.
Point none, bar none.
I think the part where I'm up to in the beginning of Infinity is laying out the case, and we'll talk more about this in the next one, but it's laying out the case for why philosophy books are valuable.
Ah.
Of understanding universal rules, whether or not the creator of that rule wanted the rule to be universal.
Right.
So if it has a certain reach, it just has that reach. And we can respect the reach and understand it. But its reach is not intentional.
Yeah.
And its reach is not always known until later on.
I'm excited to read it because I think it's going to confront a lot of my... Like, I'm probably going to find myself arguing a little bit, but from the synopsis... Sorry, I don't know if I just said something to me. From the synopsis, I think that there's a philosophical problem called induction.
Mm.
And induction is basically you don't know that tomorrow is going to be the same as today. There is no actual – it's an assumption. Mm-hmm. Even though it's a safe assumption and we need to use induction, obviously, to live and to move through life. But you actually don't know that the laws of the universe are going to hold up tomorrow. And which sounds so stupid, a lot of people kind of get rid of it. But with a lot of guys like Steven Pinker and these sorts of people who are like, this is a good explanation as a philosophical description, doesn't deal with the problem of induction. And it doesn't deal with, I would say, someone like Nassim Taleb's contention that there are fat tails, meaning there are things that you cannot predict that have tremendously horrible consequences and have destructive consequences that are ingrained in the universe. And this idea that a good explanation is the best way to move forward without taking that into consideration is like a classic philosophical problem. So I'm excited to read it. And I really like that guy, Nassim Taleb's books. I think that we should probably read one. I would love to read one again.
Yeah, I mean, we have read his books and talked about them.
Don't forget to kill your heroes, though, Doug.
Ah, yes.
Don't forget.
Yeah.
Okay, so more to discuss on the next one for the beginning of Infinity. Hopefully Scott will not stop his recording midway. Also, we may have another person joining us for that call.
Oh, yeah.
We'll see whether or not they do, if they can also read the book and come with interesting ideas, things to discuss. So I'll see you on the next one.
Thank you for listening to How You Level Up. If you're enjoying the show, subscribe and give a 5-star rating. There are new episodes each month asking questions about timeless communication lessons. Language is a medium for sharing, and the knowledge unpacked here can be applied to anyone, anywhere, facing any challenge. If there's a question or topic you'd like me to dive into next, send a note to any of my connected social media accounts. This is all about how you level up.